Seven deadly sins. We don't think in those terms very often today. In fact, we don't think of ourselves as sinners much at all. We think of ourselves as victims, as adult children of something, as codependents, anything but sinner. And we've taken that the next step and decided that since we're not sinners, then there really can't be sin. The problem with that line of thinking is that that is contradictory to what the Bible says, and the biblical message is a message for sinners. And if there are no sinners, then there's no need of a Savior, and if there's no need of a Savior, then Christ's coming is really not that important. In fact, God is foolish if we're not sinners. We're going to look at lust this morning, and to get us started, I'm going to ask you to indulge me for just a minute or two. And I'm going to ask you to do that by closing your eyes. We're not going to do anything kinky. Close your eyes. And just for a few seconds, picture in your mind your favorite vacation place. Just close your eyes and picture your favorite vacation place. And picture yourself being there. Let me ask you, how many of you are at the beach now? Okay, we got a few beach people. How many of you are in the mountains? How many of you are fishing in a boat? Oh, there's Tom. Yeah. Now, keep your eyes closed for just a minute. Now picture in your mind the home you remember best growing up. Picture being at the dinner table. My guess is you even know the order, how everyone sat. Your mom sat there and dad, your brothers and sisters. Everybody's in the right place. Now, picture yourself standing on the tee of your favorite golf hole, looking down on the fairways, and in your mind, you're picturing the golf hole, and while you're there, you're picturing that perfect shot that you're going to be hitting. Okay, now, open your eyes and picture yourself back here at Biblical. And for a minute, just marvel with me at this incredible gift that God's given us called imagination. In our minds, we can travel back in time and remember positive things that have happened in our lives. We can project ourselves into the future. And in a sense, we can practice what we want to do then. And you can go over and over it in your mind so that when the opportunity comes, you can do it more naturally. Imagination is a significant gift that God gave. Imagination helps leaders create vision for their corporation or organization. Imagination helps those of us that may be in difficult situations muster up courage because we can picture ourselves being on the other side of that difficulty. And yet, this creative good gift that God has given, called imagination, has a dark side to it. And if you can't imagine what that dark side is, then you don't have much imagination. And it's that dark side of that creative gift of imagination that sometimes gets us into trouble. Because just as we can put ourselves in our mind into God-honoring, ministry kind of positions, so in our mind we can put ourselves into God-dishonoring, self-destructive situations, and we can wind up squandering our time and our energy, dishonoring God, and actually rehearsing things that we should not be doing. And a principle that you'll probably hear me say a few times this morning is that what you're thinking of in your mind today, you're becoming tomorrow. And for some of us, that's pretty frightening stuff, isn't it? Because what we're contemplating and thinking and mulling over and over in our mind is God dishonoring and self problematic or self-depreciating. We can play games in our mind, and nobody else knows. In fact, right now, some of you are probably playing the imagination game. You're looking at me, pretending that you're listening and smiling, but you're still at your favorite golf hole. Or maybe some of you are actually doing what we're going to talk about today, and you're wondering what your secretary or what that other woman at work is going to be wearing today. Or maybe you're still thinking of the billboard, or you're still thinking of what the radio guys were talking about on the way in, and you're playing with dishonoring thoughts in your mind. You see, that positive gift called imagination has a dark side, and the one slice of the dark side that we're going to talk about today is the dark side of lust. It's against this backdrop of imagination that in Matthew 5, verses 27 through 30, Jesus marches onto the human minefield of sexuality. And I realize that these words are going to sound maybe even a little coarse for us today, but you have to realize back in the first century, they didn't even talk about sex in private, let alone in public very much. And so here's Jesus preaching a sermon. In the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, people have gathered around him, and Jesus fearlessly walks into the middle of that crowd, and he talks about sexuality and how sexuality sometimes infiltrates our imagination and presents problems. Here's what he says beginning in verse 27. You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks on a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Jesus says to the crowd that day, I'll paraphrase, lots of you are feeling pretty self-righteous right now because I'm going to talk about adultery. And in your mind, you're saying, hey, I've got this problem licked. I've never slept in the wrong bed. Jesus says, but you may still have the problem. Because even though you may have always slept in the right bed, you've been hopping from bed to bed in your mind and in your heart all the time, and that's a problem. Because if you regularly commission your imagination to crank out X-rated videos starring you, then you've got a problem. And the problem is, Jesus says, that the righteousness meter of God doesn't get strapped to our hands and our tongues and our feet. God straps his righteousness meter to our hearts. And if you're committing adultery in your heart, then you're not living the pure life that Jesus calls us to live. And that's a problem. Jesus says, I have come to call people to be pure in act and to be pure in heart. To be sexually pure to the core. And what he tells us in these verses is that there are a number of ways to commit adultery. You can commit adultery naked in a motel room, or you can commit adultery fully clothed in your living room. You can commit adultery in your office all by yourself, or you can commit adultery even at one of the BWB tables. You see, mental adultery and physical adultery come from the same disease of the heart. And it's that disease that Jesus speaks to and says, I came to change hearts. And as your heart is purified, your life and actions will be purified. But if you just try to purify the actions without doing any heart work, then all you're doing is trading symptoms and becoming a legalist. And so it's to that problem that Jesus speaks. On your outline, we're going to look at three things this morning. The first thing that I want to look at is just a little continuum. And I'm not going to ask you to put an X where you fall on that continuum, but I think that that continuum is helpful to realize that God calls us to what we would call his ideal, to love people. After all, when the lawyer comes to Jesus and says, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, obviously, your neighbor includes women as well as men. And Jesus says, if God's ideal is love, then that's where we need to be living. Well, let's ask the question, with that continuum in front of us, how do people who reside at the different places on that continuum look at women? How would somebody who resides all the way over on the love side, how would that kind of man look at a woman? Well, I think that we could say, if you live at that end of the continuum called love and you look at a woman, you would probably see that woman as someone made in God's image. And here's the key, guys. We would see a woman made multifaceted by God's design. We would see a person that has intellectual capabilities, emotion. They're capable of relationship. In fact, right now, she would be in multiple relationships, family, friends, work, associates. Also a spiritual person that was designed to have a relationship with God, and she was created as a physical being. Multifaceted. We could probably spin out a few more, but that's enough to make the point. If you live at the love end of the continuum, you do not reduce that woman to a single aspect, but you realize they have multi-dimensions. And so if you live at that end of the continuum, maybe some of your conversation or your thinking would be, I wonder what this woman is thinking about. I wonder how she spends her time thinking. What has she been reading lately? Emotional. What is this woman feeling these days? What pressures and stresses are impacting her life today? Relational. I wonder what kind of family she has. What kind of husband? How does she get irritated by him and how does she irritate him? How about the kids? Are there kids involved? Does she get along with her in-laws? Does she and her parents get along well these days? Spiritual. I wonder if this woman has a relationship with God. I wonder how she's doing in a relationship with God these days. Is she growing in that relationship? Is she stagnant in that relationship? Or is she going backward in that relationship? And yes, she has a physical side, and you can look and you can see that side, but it's a multifaceted look. It's not the focusing in on one aspect, it's the multifaceted look. And love says, I want God's best for you. It's not that I want to get something from you or to use you or manipulate you. I want to minister to you, and if I can be part of bringing God's best into your life, then I volunteer to do that. Now, that's a little bit what it looks like to look at a woman from the love end of the continuum. Now, here's the problem. We live in 1995. And so, there are a lot of forces and pressures that impact our lives that make that kind of look difficult. For example, take a typical day or a series of days in maybe your life or my life. You wake up in the morning to Angelo, Tony, and Al on WIP. And you realize that Wing Bowl 3 is coming up soon, and not only are they looking for Heavy Kevy and the crew to eat wings, they're also looking for wingettes these days. And as they begin the discussion looking for these wingettes, you realize that what they really want to talk about is what these wingettes will wear at the Wing Bowl. And Angelo likes to go into great detail concerning what they're wearing or what they're not wearing. And as you're listening, you're beginning to shift your imagination into gear, aren't you? And kind of through the radio waves, you're wondering what these women look like and what they will look like on Wing Bowl Day. Well, you get in your car and you drive to work, and maybe you realize that you shouldn't be listening to Angelo, Tony, and Al this morning. But billboard after billboard approach you, right? And they're selling, it doesn't matter what they're selling, but they all look the same what they're selling. They're not wearing that much. And again, they're feeding that dark side of your imagination. You get into work and you find there are a couple magazines on your desk, and maybe they're news magazines. Maybe it's Newsweek, Time, maybe it's U.S. News, whatever. And you thumb through and you realize there are even titillating pictures in there sometimes that feed that dark side of your imagination. You go home, you're waiting for dinner, you turn on the television, and even on the news, images, models begin to feed that side. You watch a movie that night. All of a sudden, when you meet a woman, question, how do you look at her? You don't look at her as a multifaceted image bearer of God anymore, do you? You look at her as a physical entity. You look at her as a physical object that really doesn't have those other aspects, or if they do, all they do is make life messy. And you wish those other aspects weren't there. So that's kind of what the middle ground is like. The middle ground is a battleground, isn't it? It's a battleground in our day of trying to take all of those pressures and forces that want to feed the dark side of our imagination and make our hearts lust. It's trying to say no to that stuff, and in the meantime, feeding your mind with good thoughts so that you have something to combat those images with. Well, how about the lust end of the continuum? If that's the middle, what's the lust end? Well, some of us probably fit more on this end than even in the middle. And I don't say that to make you feel bad. I say that to try to help us look honestly at our lives. And what that means is that when you meet a person of the opposite sex, what happens is that you are riveted to the physical aspect of that person. Quite frankly, you don't give a rip what she's thinking. You could care less what she's feeling. You never think of relationships that she may have. And you're not really concerned as to whether she's a believer or not. You're just enthralled and captivated and focused on her physical being. And if you're there and you don't want to be there, you know how difficult that is to live there. Women kind of understand what this is like a whole lot better than men. If you live on the lust end of the continuum, you are reductionistic by nature, right? You reduce this human being that's multifaceted and has many different aspects into one aspect, and that one aspect you want to use for your gratification. And so you focus in on that. Let me just ask you, and you don't have to answer. Has your wife ever said to you, "You only want one thing. The only time you're nice to me is when you want to have sex. You never hold my hand unless you want something later." You see, all those comments our wives are saying to us, "You're treating me like a unidimensional person or a unidimensional object rather than a multidimensional image bearer of God." You see, it doesn't have to be outside of marriage. It can even be in marriage. Well, if you live on this end of the continuum called lust, my guess is that you not only accidentally find those images in Time and Newsweek, you look for them when they come. And maybe you get home before your wife and, you know, you find that Victoria's Secret came today. And you have to check that out just to make sure you know what your wife's going to look at a little later. And all of those images, and maybe it goes beyond that and it's pornography, softcore, hardcore, whatever. You see, people that live on the lust end of the continuum have reduced women to a unidimensional object. And in doing that, pornography is the natural next step, isn't it? Because what's pornography all about? It's all about not having to deal with all of the messiness of a relationship. All you see is a unidimensional object. You don't have to worry about what she's thinking. You don't have to worry about what she's feeling. She's not going to cry. I mean, she's there for your pleasure and for your gratification. And if you live on the lust end of the spectrum, you want these objects, these unidimensional objects, to be used for your gratification. And if you've lived there a long time and you've met a couple of people or a couple of women during the day that have really kind of set your mind thinking, that night you'll think about them again, won't you? And you'll begin to produce one of those videos in your mind. And you'll be the star. And she'll be the co-star. And Jesus says, that's a problem. That's a problem for people who are in my kingdom. Because I have come to clean up hearts. I've come to change the videos you play in your mind. And if you're playing the wrong videos, that's a problem. In fact, the same producer that spins out X-rated videos in your mind produces the act just a little further down the road. It's a serious issue. Don't make too light of it. I don't know where you live on that continuum, but we all live somewhere on there. And I would also say we're all moving in one direction or the other. You're either moving toward love, multidimensional image bearer, ministry for God's best, or you're moving toward lust, unidimensional object that I'll use and manipulate for my self-gratification. One or the other. We're moving toward one of those destinations. Lust is really a prison. And if you've ever spoken to someone that is imprisoned by it, you know exactly what I'm saying. There are some reasons that lust imprisons our hearts, imprisons our lives. I just mentioned a couple of them. First of all, lust distorts the nature and purpose of sex. Don't think by what I'm saying this morning that sex is a bad idea. It's a good idea. It's one of God's good gifts. It's a good gift. It's God's gift. He dreamed it up. It's not a human invention. The problem is that God intended love and sex to go together. In fact, if you think about it for a minute, love or sex is kind of physical, a picture of what love should be. You know, multidimensional oneness pictured in physical oneness. And so if you think of the multi-dimensions that we mentioned, you know, intellectual, relational, emotional, if all of those things with your marriage partner are in harmony and are one, then sexual intercourse is kind of a picture of the oneness that the two of you share. But ever since the fall, love and sex have been separated. And now we think of love and we think of sex as very different things. We even say things that say, women are into love, men are into sex. But that wasn't God's intent. God's intent was that sex would be a picture of multifaceted love within the bonds of marriage. But we've taken that and distorted it, and lust blows that distortion completely out of perspective, doesn't it? Lust has nothing to do with multi-dimensions. Lust has nothing to do with giving. In fact, lust has very little to do with love. Lust has everything to do with getting rather than giving or ministering. Lust always distorts what God intends for sex. Secondly, lust violates the law of love. In this whole section on the Sermon on the Mount here, Jesus is really telling his listeners that they need to be loving. And so he says, do not murder people. That's not a loving thing to do. In fact, don't get angry with them, because the same thing that produces anger produces murder in your heart. And so be lovers of people, not people that are angry and murderous. And then he says later in divorce, following this section, love your spouse. Don't do the unloving thing by writing divorce certificates, but do the loving thing by working out those issues. Do the loving thing by telling the truth and being open and honest. All of Matthew 5, in a sense, can be seen through the lens of love. And so if we take that perspective back to what he says about adultery, we can say lust violates the law of love, because love is all about God's intent and God's best, and lust is all about getting what I want. Biblical love for the opposite sex has to do with those multi-dimensions, has to do with stepping into those multi-dimensions and being used by God to edify and to take them the next step in their relationship with God. But that's different than what we often experience, and that's different what we think, because we tend to be more lusting than we are loving. Lust always violates the law of love. Lust also tends to be progressive in nature. I hinted at that a few minutes ago when I said, you're either moving toward love or moving toward lust, but you're not staying put on the continuum. There are too many pressures and too much force being exerted in our culture to remain static. And so if you're becoming what you're thinking, then you're moving either toward love or toward lust. And what you feed your mind has some to do with which direction you move on the continuum. Here's a letter that I found in a book a number of weeks ago that speaks of this prison and the progressive nature of lust. This guy writes, I am an emotional invalid. Lust is eating me up. It paralyzes my spiritual life. It perverts my view of women. It distorts my social life. It wreaks havoc in my emotional stability. It destroys any possibility of God using me in my church, but I can't stop. Recently, I've become addicted to pornography, which has just intensified the problem. The sad thing is, I know that lust and pornography promise everything and produce nothing, but I can't seem to stop. That's a prisoner, isn't it? He knows he's imprisoned. He knows that he should stop. He can't. He's in bondage. We would say that, yeah, he's living pretty close to the lust end of the spectrum. He's been trapped. Well, I don't want to spend the bulk of our time looking at the continuum and lust and what lust distorts. I want to talk about what Jesus talks about. And that's how to get delivered from that prison, or how to get moving in the right direction, whichever one of those help your thinking better. Let me go back and read again, and let's see if we can tease out some helpful hints that Jesus gives to get us moving in the right direction on the continuum, even though a lot of forces in our world are pushing us the other way. Jesus again says, "You've heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell." I would say, first of all, that we need to rejoice in the fact that God made us as sexual beings. I know some of you are saying, wait a minute, I mean, this sexual being stuff is what's making me have this problem, and you're telling me to rejoice in it. Yeah, but sexuality is a good gift. God doesn't give bad gifts to his children, he gives good gifts to his children. Now, sure, trying to navigate in the course of life with this thing called male sexuality is like trying to steer a canoe in the rapids, but it can be done, and it needs to be done, and we need to rejoice in the fact that God made us as sexual beings, and that God made us as men, and God made us with the sex drive that we have. They're good things. So don't begin to look at your sexuality and the sex drive that you have as being a negative. It's never presented that way in the Bible. You can take that sex energy and color outside the lines with it. Use that energy to play imagination games. Use that energy to commit actual adultery. Use that energy to feed your own lust. And if you do that, then it is going to be God-dishonoring and self-destructive. But if you use that energy in proper channels, it's a good gift. Rejoice in the day that one day you're going to control your sexuality. Maybe that's not today, but hopefully you're seeing progress on that continuum, and rejoice that God made you a sexual being, and rejoice in the fact that one day it will be controlled. Maybe that day will be heaven, but it's coming, and we should rejoice in that fact. And I would say that when you find yourself lusting in your heart, or when you're talking to that woman, and all of a sudden, you know, what she's thinking and feeling is just slipping quickly through your grasp. At that moment, you know, ask God for strength and confess your failures and move on. Keep your mind at the task and keeping, you know, keep your mind on a leash in a sense. And as you do that, you can rejoice in the fact that God made you a sexual being. Secondly, and this is what Jesus primarily talks about, remove whatever it is that drives your lustful thoughts. Cut your hands off. Rip your eyes out. And that'll help. We don't pass offering plates here, but if we did, we could collect all our body parts, maybe, and that would solve the problem. But in a sense, we know that that wouldn't solve the problem, right? Because a guy can lust with one eye just as well as he can with two. And you can lust without hands just as well as you can lust with hands. So the issue is not whether you have all your body parts or not. The issue is, what are you doing with the body parts that you have? I think the principle that Jesus is saying here is that radical surgery is necessary to cut stuff out of your life that gets your mind going toward lust. And at times, that's going to be painful surgery, right? I've never met anybody yet who likes surgeries. Well, spiritual surgery has that same kind of aspect to it. It's painful. And we'd be dishonest if we failed to admit it. A while ago, I read a story about a man who, when he was in his early 40s, saw his life's dream come true. This is a true story. Now, this was a crazy man, right? His life's dream was to sail around the world in a 40-foot sailboat all by himself. I mean, this guy's nuts. Well, anyway, he sets out and he makes it across the Atlantic. Halfway across the Indian Ocean, he's up fixing something on one of the masts. He falls off the mast to the deck of the ship. He severely injures his lower right arm. I mean, this isn't a little scratch or cut. This guy has a serious injury, but he's in the middle of the Indian Ocean. So he tries to work on it as best he can, to no avail. Over a period of 2 or 3 weeks, gangrene sets in. He can barely stand the stench from his arm, let alone the pain. So after a few weeks of trying to doctor this thing to health, he goes down and he looks for one of the few survival manuals that he brought. And so he looks in the manual, and here's what the manual says you should do if a situation like this occurs. He says, well, you should check for gangrene, and if you have gangrene, follow the following steps. Number one, go to your toolbox. Number two, take out the hacksaw. Number three, go to work.